weaving the threads of art, culture, and history, Maggie Eyre creates an oral tapestry.
The horse keeps watch. The wind plays in his hair. His eyes burn like two huge worlds. He hears the talk of leaves and stones. Intent, he knows the animals cry and the nightingales murmur in the copse. And knowing all, to whom may he retell his visions?
Our fascination with the horse stretches back to ancient times. Early man painted him on the walls of his cave dwelling, primitive depictions of Eohippus, the dawn horse, who lived 55 million years ago. Genghis Khan raced him over the Asiatic plains. The Greeks worshipped him. The Romans honoured him. Through the ages, the horse has been man's servant, used for sport in Roman chariot races, wild game hunting, and flat racing. He's entertained us in the circus ring, in Wild West shows, in the Spanish riding school. He has been our beast of burden, our means of transport. He's carried soldiers into battle. He is an instrument of war. The horse symbolizes freedom, tamed yet untamed, a creature of beauty and grace, speed and agility, mythologized by peoples the world over. In the Upanishads, the ancient Indian Psalms, a horse is sacrificed and becomes the universe, physically embodying the world. The immortal winged horse Pegasus, offspring of Medusa and Poseidon, is central to Greek mythology. The Norse god Odin's horse is Sleipnir, a grey with eight legs who can travel over water as well as land. Writer and storyteller Hugh Lupton performs Psalms from the Horse's Mouth, in which he cites the horse's seemingly psychic, almost supernatural powers.
There's this long association between man and horse, and going back and back and back, and they think that probably the centaurs might even be a memory of the first men riding horses, approaching men who had only ever hunted horses, and this vision of kind of half horse, half man. And I suppose the horse also, kind of on a symbolic level, represents a kind of instinctive self, our instinctive side. Horses are incredibly sensitive. They're very sensitive to the supernatural. A horse will suddenly stop and nothing will move it. There's always been this sense of horses being tuned in to things that we can't quite sense ourselves. A very fine radar.
In much mythology, the horse is shown as the mediator between two worlds. In the ancient Irish story of Coneda, a stallion takes a girl into the other world. And the Navajo Indians have a tale of how the horses came into our world from another. In the Bible, Revelation 6, John says, "And there as I looked was a pale horse, and his rider's name was Death, and Hades came close behind." And the nightmare, many people forget, is just that, a horse that comes in the middle of the night to transport us to the other world.
The horse carries the dead from the world of men to the world of the dead. And there's a long tradition of the horse as kind of a mediator between worlds. I mean, a lot of burials, people were buried with their horses because they would need their horses to carry them to where they had to go next. I think it's this sort of shamanic thing of, again, the horse as a symbol for whatever it is that carries you into the other, and the other isn't always comfortable. And I think the nightmare is a memory of this mare that takes you into the dark side of experience. The night is hushed. In the dark sky, constellations rise. And if a man should see that face, if a man should see that magical face, then he would tear out his tongue and give it to the horse, for surely he is worthy of it. Then we would hear words. Then we would hear words as large as apples, as thick as honey or buttermilk, as true as oak, as precious as gold or poppies or corn, as strange as the races of dead and unborn, words as sharp as thorns, words like ancient songs that once heard would never be forgotten. Well, horses have disappeared from the world. I mean, not completely, but they're not part of our lives in the way that they were two generations ago. Up until the 1920s, everyone was using horses. Every farm was using horses. Horses were absolutely integral to people's lives. And now it's really gone. You know, a few people keep horses to ride for fun, but they're not part of our lives in the way they were.
When we think of the horse now, what springs to mind? Putting money on one to win at the races, or little girls and their love of ponies, horse whisperers and cowboys in the American West, or the heavy horse behind the plough or pulling the cart. The horse is no longer a necessity in our lives. He is a luxury item used only for sport and leisure. Yet the history of art teaches us that the horse has always been a sign of wealth and luxury. The Romans painted frescoes of their noble steeds on the walls of their villas. The Turkish emperors bred them, and the Hindu and Muslim rulers of the Indian subcontinent imported them from the Middle East. Horses appeared on works of art as symbols of beauty and prestige. In the West, they developed a great importance.
From the 1430s and 1440s, European slavery starts to take off in a big way. As the Portuguese sail down the west coast of Africa, they begin to pick up West African slaves and barter with them. What's interesting is that one of the main commodities that they barter with is the horse. And in fact, the whole new technology of shipbuilding within the period develops something called the Nau Taffarai, which is a Portuguese ship, which is a large round-bottom boat which is deliberately designed to ship and transport horses primarily, slaves secondarily. So the usual trade within the period is that one horse equals eight slaves. Horses are seen as much more important than slaves.
This shocking story illustrates a point made in a new book by Dr. Jerry Broughton of the University of Holloway in London and his co-author Lisa Jardine. Global Interests argues that horses have a cultural significance in the West that's been all but forgotten today. The author's study of art from the early 1400s traces the horse's origins to Eastern kingdoms.
The most prized horses come from the East. They're Persian, they're Arab. They originally emanate from Afghanistan, from the Bactrian region. So one thing that we tend to forget when we think about horses in the 21st century is that ultimately their provenance is Eastern, and therefore that's why for particularly the Renaissance, they are the most prized horses. They're the fastest, they're the most aesthetically elegant, they are that which the princes of the period desire.
During the Crusades, horses were brought back from the Middle East and introduced into the European courts as trophies. There's an underlying idea of the foreign power being subdued by the Christian rider mastering the Arab horse. And Global Interests argues that this becomes apparent in the works of art of the time. While man had always admired the beauty and nobility of the horse, portraying his likeness on walls, medals, and tapestries, these early representations were rather primitive. It was in the 15th century, during the Renaissance period, that Jerry Broughton says equestrian art in the West began to develop a whole new significance.
Well, I think that we shouldn't separate out the way in which the horse has a classical lineage. So the great Roman equestrian statues of Marcus Aurelius, of Charlemagne, are the iconic classical images of great equine beauty. Now, that's something that is taken up in the Renaissance and that is yoked together with a consideration of form, of shape, of physiognomy. And so the two come together to create this much more realistic representation of the horse. Because even prior to the Renaissance, you can see these representations of horses which are actually bad. They're just not very good. So I think that what happens with the Renaissance is a pulling together of both the classical aesthetic representation and the very precise, realistic imaging.
Often drawings, paintings and engravings of the horse featured a groom or servant standing beside the animal. One such picture of a dark Barbary horse shows the animal standing in front of a stately home being led by a black groom, a detail which has great significance for the time.
Barbary horses emanate from North Africa. And so again, what we forget is we see the Barbary horse today and we don't recognise its ethnic or its racial otherness. Now, within the period, that would have been much more marked. So you repeatedly get within the period of the Renaissance an image of a Barbary or often a Turkish or an Arabian horse, which invariably comes with its own groom. It's a bit like, you know, buying your new complex commodity today and that you need a guide to go with it to explain how the horse works, how you might then be able to breed the horse. So invariably what you see is that the ethnic difference of the horse is represented through the groom that comes with it. The groom is invariably black. There's a whole slew of later 17th century paintings, English royal portraits, where you get this Van Dyck representing great Arabian chargers that come with the black groom. And again, I think that what's going on there is a representation that the period understands the ethnic difference of the horse, which is both something which is celebrated because the horse is that which you desire, which doesn't come from Northern Europe, but it's also a slightly anxious and troubling object precisely because of its ethnic difference.
During the 15th century, the wealthy courts of Renaissance Italy began commissioning artists to reproduce images of their best horses to show off their wealth and power. Leonardo da Vinci was commissioned to build a statue of a horse for the nobility, and he began studying and drawing horses from life. This period saw the emergence of the equestrian statue, perhaps the most challenging art form artists had ever had to contend with.
There are many different representational forms. I mean, you get, for instance, somebody like Da Vinci, whose beautiful drawings of the Sforza horse are drawn on silver point. So again, there's this move from basically quite simple medium pencil drawings that will then be transferred into frescoes, into oil painting. But of course, one of the most difficult medium that is used in the period is the creation of equestrian statues. So there's a whole tradition in the late 15th century whereby people like Da Vinci are trying to cast magnificent, huge horses several metres high. Now, of course, this produces problems because if you're representing a rearing horse, then you've got whole problems around the weight of a huge piece of bronze that you're trying to sculpt. And of course, when a cast is made from that, which repeatedly happens, the legs will break off. The issue of the rearing horse, of course, comes from a Roman prototype, the idea of an imperial triumph, that the rearing horse with the imperial commander is always seen as rearing, and either you have a foe underneath the hooves, or even if not, what we forget is that the image of the rearing horse is always a very threatening and aggressive gesture. If it's, say, an Arab or a Turk that a Christian prince is trampling on, even when we don't see it, and that happens with the Sforza horse, you know that it's an image of the connection between the imperial commander and what the horse represents in terms of military might. The fact that he's represented on this horse rearing is a symbol of imperial dominion and imperial authority. So when we see equestrian portraits represented in that way, we kind of forget that they have a much more terrifying and aggressive representation than we think of today. We just think it's a man on a horse.
Da Vinci's statue of the Sforza horse was designed as a monument to the authority and might of the Sforza family of Milan, who had seized power from the Viscontis in 1450. It was intended as a grandiose statement of strength and triumph, the iconic rearing horse. It was to test the artist's technical and engineering skills to the limit.
If you want a certain type of horse, how are you going to actually cast it as well as sculpt it? And so increasingly throughout the Renaissance you get more ambitious attempts to sculpt horses, which is when you get the emergence of this iconic rearing figure. If you have a pacing horse, it's easier to cast. If you have a rearing horse, which is upon its hind legs, that's incredibly difficult to do. So there's a way in which casting and representing the horse is itself a technical and artistic challenge, which is one of the reasons that the horse fascinates Renaissance artists. The first time that Da Vinci tries to cast the Sforza horse in the 1490s, the cast is set it's then broken apart and the legs are broken off. So again, he then has to go back to the drawing board and recast the horse and actually lower the position at which the horse is rearing. And there are repeated attempts around this period to cast the Sforza horse and get it right.
During the Renaissance, the military symbolism of the rearing horse developed as European nations began conquering others and establishing themselves as colonial powers. By far the most powerful example of the horse as the conqueror of the infidel, according to Jerry Broughton, is a painting from the mid-1500s by the Italian artist Tiziano Vecelli, or Titian. Entitled Charles V at the Battle of Mulberg, it's a symbol of the victory of the Holy Roman Empire over the Protestant foe. The horse is the central point of the action.
Titian paints a portrait of Charles V, the Holy Roman Habsburg Emperor, in 1548. It's called Charles V at the Battle of Mulberg. It's in the Prado in Spain at the moment. It's an extraordinarily aesthetically beautiful image of Charles riding into battle on a large black horse. The Battle of Mulberg is basically Charles's victory over the Protestant German forces of Philip of Hesse. So it's a very iconic moment of Catholic Habsburg power crushing Reformed Protestant religion. Now, what's interesting is the fact that the one thing that looks out of the portrait and catches our eye is not Charles, but the horse. The horse meets our gaze. The horse is an Andalusian horse. It's therefore a crossed bred horse. It's half Spanish, half Arabic. What's interesting about it is that when Titian first paints the painting, Aretino, who's a very good friend of Titian's, advises him to draw on an earlier equestrian tradition, which is to show the horse rearing much more aggressively than we see. In the actual painting, Charles is really going at a canter. Aretino advises him to have it rearing, as though it's trampling on a foe, either a Protestant or possibly a Turk. Any type of infidel will do, because of course in this period Protestants and Turks are both seen as infidels. Titian lowers the horse, but in x-rays that you can actually consult in the Prado, you can see that in an earlier version he does have the horse rearing. So what he's clearly doing is he's getting the message across that this is an image of crushing the foe, of Charles crushing his adversary. But what he then does in the final version of the painting is he produces a more considered image which lowers it, gives it more of an image of a canter. So I think that the violence is in a sense masked. It's masked for us, but for the period, it's very, very clear. And of course, what it's also about is it's about Charles managing the horse, and he's literally managing the crossbreeding. He's controlling the Arabic blood in the horse, just in the same way as he's controlling and overtaking and crushing the Protestant foe.
Does it also perhaps imply too that he has done that, the sort of an unchallenged authority there?
Yes, I think that that's partly what's happening, and that also it makes it a more timeless image. If you had a rearing horse which shows a Protestant foe being crushed, for us, we'd read it as a much more narrowly political painting, and it probably wouldn't have the same aesthetic impact that it still does. So I think it's Titian playing very, very clever games with creating a more timeless equestrian image that we can put in the whole tradition of Marcus Aurelius, Da Vinci, and right through into Stubbs and later equestrian portraits. So I think that it is about saying, this has happened, this is Charles crushing the adversary, but it's very subliminal. And I think that that's Titian being very astute about creating a more timeless image, despite the fact that, of course, he's producing exactly the type of commission that Charles wants to celebrate the military victory that he's undertaken.
The beginning of the 16th century saw the emergence of horse breeding in Europe as the nobility's taste and need for fine Eastern horses developed. Not only were they objects of great value and beauty, they were important in military terms.
Portugal and England, as two of the powerful colonising nations, began to realise the importance of creating a stock of fine war horses to strengthen national security. Many of these horses were bred or bought in Holland and the Low Countries, and they often included the mighty Black Frisians, which themselves had been bred from an originally Middle Eastern breed from Andalusia in Spain.
The Dutch, or what we might call more generally the Low Countries in this period, the Dutch or the Low Countries are actually the entrepot. They're basically the marketplace where horse dealing takes place. So they're really not involved in breeding itself. So there's huge horse marts and marketplaces that take place in the Low Countries. The Low Countries are the places that you go for all your commodities. It happens, the English do it, the Habsburgs do it, the French do it. It's basically just the big marketplace of the early modern world. And horses basically come from the East. They even cross the Channel from England because the heavy English horses are also desirable. Friesland horses, of course, from the north of the Low Countries are also very desirable. Horses from Spain, what we call the Andalusian horse, also comes up into the Low Countries. And what's interesting is the fact that one phrase that's often used is the idea of Flanders horses and Flanders mares. So there's the wonderful story of Henry VIII. When Henry VIII receives a portrait of his future wife, Anne of Cleves, in about 1540, when Henry actually meets her, he says, "My God, they've brought me a Flanders mare." Now, actually, I think that what's going on there is that it's not Henry saying she's very ugly. What he's saying is she's a breeder, not a looker. And the problem that happens, of course, is that she doesn't successfully breed. So in that way, Flanders and the Low Countries are seen as the receptacle of horses, of that which you can breed successfully with. And so everybody takes from the Low Countries. It's not until much later that they begin themselves to actually breed horses successfully themselves and define their own culture. It's very much a golden age moment, which is later in the 17th century.
England, in particular, was quick to establish royal breeding studs under Henry VIII, consisting of Barbary and Arab horses. These thoroughbreds were the predecessors of the modern racehorse, fast and agile.
I think that when the imperial colonial moment of the emergence of the British Empire takes place, the horse, just like the idea of the ship and the navy, becomes something which is hugely developed, rapidly developed, to create the right type of horse for whatever military venture you might be undertaking. But it really goes all the way back to the early 16th century and reaches a high point in the beginning of the 18th century. And I think that's where you get people like Stubbs' great equestrian images of horses, which again become more familiar to us. And again, that's telling us something about a native type of breeding, that the English do this best. And I think that that's one of the things that's happening with this sudden flowering of equestrian art, native equestrian art in England from the 18th century onwards.
As the horse slowly began to be replaced on the battlefield by the gun and cannon, so his artistic status as an exotic and powerful weapon evolved into a more recreational one. Horses were painted performing a variety of sporting and pastoral activities. The Dutch artist Paulus Potter was founder of the animal painting genre, featuring horses in a natural setting. Horse racing was revived as a sport in Europe in the late 17th century, and this led to a new style of equestrian painting. Fox hunting on horseback produced a demand for sporting pictures, and George Stubbs led the sporting school of artists, painting horses and riders in the manner of an early sports photographer. And the French impressionist Degas painted racehorses too, fascinated by their shape and movement. This recreational portrayal of horses was nothing new, though. It was simply that the military image had dominated for so long.
I think to some extent it's always there, because again, within the Renaissance period, there's always a distinction between how you breed your horses for warfare and how you breed your horses for leisure and for sport. And that happens with the Gonzaga dynasty, it happens with the D'Este dynasty, it happens with Henry VIII, it happens with Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottomans, similarly fascinated by these representations of equestrian art. So I think in a sense it's always there. There's always a subliminal message of supremacy and authority that still comes with your recreational representation of the horse. But of course, the idea of the Eastern horse, because it's small, quick, fast and manoeuvrable, is always ultimately the more desirable horse for recreation. So I think that implicitly it's always there, but the military and the imperial is always so overdetermined within the Renaissance, because there's so much desire to define a new way of colonizing and defining an imperial ethos. I think within the 18th and 19th century, that becomes much more separated out, because that tradition is already established. So you can quite easily have your iconic portrait of, you know, your figure of Napoleon or Wellington or whoever on their rearing horse. And then you can also have that same person in a much more relaxed, recreational situation, riding their different type of horse. So then the situation becomes much more relaxed. Within the Renaissance, they're always tied together. So I would think that it's much more of a later 18th and 19th century tradition. And of course, that's when the horse itself starts to wither away to some extent, that it's not the be-all and end-all of military supremacy. Issues such as naval warfare, the emergence of the gun anyway, and cannon become much more important. So again, you get that slight residual sense of the horse as being such a powerful, iconic image.
One of the last genres to use horses as a central feature is the art of the American West. Painters such as George Catlin, Henry Farney, and Frank Tenney Johnson mythologized the life of the Plains Indians and the cowboys at the turn of the 20th century. Today, the horse in painting tends to be shown either as a sporting beauty or as a mythological creature, with its roots in the ancient legends. Elsewhere in the arts, we're still occasionally given the odd glimpse of equine beauty and wisdom in works of art such as the disturbing drama Equus, the best-selling book of the Horse Whisperer, and in this poem by the late Ted Hughes, simply called The Horses. I climbed through woods in the hour before dawn, dark, evil air of frost making stillness. Not a leaf, not a bird, a world cast in frost, I came out above the wood, where my breath left tortuous statues in the iron light. But the valleys were draining the darkness, till the moorline, blackening dregs of the brightening grey, halved the sky ahead. And I saw the horses, huge in the dense grey, 10 together. Megalith still they breathed, making no move, with draped manes and tilted hind hooves, making no sound. I passed, not one snorted or jerked its head. Grey silent fragments of a grey silent world.
Wishes Were Horses was produced and presented by Maggie Eyre.